Hello, and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people, too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today, we'll be talking about secrets of the caves and ancient humans, and I'm happy to have as my guest Dr. John Hawks, Chair and Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor in the Department of Anthropology. John Hawks, thanks so much for coming in. This is you are doing some really fascinating stuff.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. So, it's Halloween.
Yep.
And you are involved in paleontology and anthropology, right?
That's right.
And so part of what you're doing is digging around in caves, looking at bones, looking at, you know, all these, you know, ancient cultures. And one of the things you study, and I want to open with this because of the Halloween theme, is burial rituals, things that humans do to honor the dead, or whatever that they do in order to deal with death and loss. And what are you finding, particularly in very ancient civilizations?
Yeah, the, you know, I've gotten engaged in this kind of research because our work in South Africa has uncovered an ancient human relative, the species we call Homo naledi, that has many, many bodies deep, deep in a cave. And those bodies, some of them were buried. Holes were dug, the body was put into it, the body was covered up. And we're working to understand that. This is a species that's a relative of ours, but pretty different from us in some ways. Okay. Its brain is much smaller, for instance.
And give me a timeline where, like, we know a little bit about Lucy, we know a little bit about some of the stages in evolution. Where does this fall?
So the whole span of human evolution is about 6 million years in length.
Right.
And Lucy, for instance, 3.5 million years old, about halfway up to the present day. Yeah. The species I'm studying is about 250,000 years old. That's the sites we're working on.
Okay.
So but our tree is quite diverse, and that tree puts this species a little bit farther from us than closer relatives like Neanderthals or Homo erectus, for instance.
Okay. So what are you finding about, either finding for real or being able to surmise about burial rituals and what it meant? And were these ways of dealing with grief, you know, kind of a more secular thing, or was it a religious thing? And what are you finding with these burial rituals?
Man, I think that that is, for us, some of the most interesting questions is, you know, today we think about death and it's tied up with religion.
Yeah.
All over the world, people have different belief systems about it. They have different practices. For some people, the most respectful thing you can do is to bury a body in expectation that someday it's going to rise again. It's a very religious belief, right? In some parts of the world, the most respectful thing you can do is to maintain the corpse in your house and keep them as a part of your family, acting as if, you know, they're somehow still connected with you. In some places, the most respectful thing you can do is expose the body so that the wild animals and vultures can take the flesh off of it. In some places, you bury a body until it decomposes, then you take parts away. You know, it's like the beliefs and the ritual are so different in different places. And when we turn to the deep past, we're trying to understand, right, where do their beliefs fit in? How does this get going? And as an anthropologist, I have to say there's almost as many ways to treat the dead as there are, as you can imagine. But one thing that's shared everywhere in the world is that there's something special that happens. You know, you do something different with a dead human than you do with any other creature, any other piece of garbage, any trash, right? Yeah. We treat the dead specially, and that's something very deep in our origin.
Yeah. Is there an earliest identifiable death ritual that you're familiar with? Yes, you're nodding. Okay.
Yeah.
Who was it and what would that be?
Right now, the earliest situation that we have in the archaeological record that clearly is associated with the death of a lot of individuals, is in a place in Spain called Cima de los Huesos. That's the pit of the bones. And this place is deep in a cave. And it's a deep shaft that has a chamber at the bottom. And that chamber, in the 1970s, when paleontologists first noticed it, it's full of cave bear bones. And as they were working on the cave bears, they found some cave lions. They started finding ancient hominins, ancient relatives of ours.
Okay.
Today, we've got some genetic information from these skeletons. We have lots and lots of them from this site. We know that this is an early population of Neanderthals, around 430,000 years ago.
All right.
But this group, somebody took bodies, bashed them on the head, and dumped them in there. And there is at least 28 individuals that were treated in this way.
Okay. Now, when you say bashed them on the head, is that how they died, or was that post-mortem? That was after.
We know that the wounds occurred around the time of death. And for us in the deep past, this is always a problem, right?
That
the bones were broken while they were fresh. That we know.
Okay, fair enough.
It seems likely that some of these people were killed, and this is where they were dumped.
Yeah.
It's not clear whether this is a group of enemies that dumped them there, if it's a, you know, somehow connected with a transition or an overthrow within a group. It's a really biased sample in the sense of there's very few kids. And so we know that somehow this is a situation that arose. We're seeing the bodies that are left from it. We know that it wasn't a random sampling of that group. It wasn't they came and killed everybody. If they did, they took the kids away. And so it's a mystery for us. And that's often the case, right?
Yeah.
It's like we have these cases in the past where it's like we find the remains and we're trying to work out, like, forensics, what happened.
Yeah. That's amazing because you're kind of, I never thought of this, but you're kind of like a detective.
Yep.
But instead of trying to solve the murder that happened 2 days ago, you're working on the death, whether it's murder or not, 400,000 years ago.
Really is.
So is that a fair representation of what you're doing?
The work that I do in South Africa, the Rising Star Cave, which is where we have these bodies of Homo naledi.
Yeah.
Some of them were buried, and then later on, somebody else, probably also Homo naledi, we think, you know, it was using the same place, came and dug new holes and put somebody else in.
Okay.
And it's all naledi, but it's multiple events. And one of the tasks that was very difficult for us was to work out, there's a jumble of bones in one little part of the system where we're excavating. We've got some places where we have a body in a hole, right?
Okay.
But there's one place that was so complex, we called it the puzzle box, because the bones were jumbled together, they were stacked one on another, and they were disordered. And the bones of, we could tell, many different individuals somehow commingled with each other.
Okay.
As we worked it out, we discovered that some of these bones were broken and moved long after death. You know, when I say long, it could be months, it could be years, but it's long enough for the bones to sort of lose their strength after burial.
All right.
And that movement we could see was consistent with someone digging through. And so you had kind of like a disruption of a grave.
Okay.
And then emplacing new bodies. That's something that we see in recent people. You know, you're recycling in a graveyard. Unless you have really clear markers and are keeping a record of where the bodies are.
Right.
If you've got a place where you're burying bodies, you're going to run into other bodies.
Yeah.
And in a 19th century context, in, you know, the Milwaukee Poor Farm Cemetery, you know, there these are places where sometimes people, you know, new graves were dug and it disrupted something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting that 250,000 years ago. It's just like spooky that the same things are happening. You can see why they're happening, but it's because the focus is not on remembering exactly where the grave is. The focus is on getting the new bodies into the same place, getting them into this special place.
Right. And so you start digging and realize, oops, there are already bodies here. And they're just going to commingle and nothing's marked and it's just,
And maybe that's the aim, you know, in a catacomb.
Yeah.
You have, you know, bones that are taken there and then removed and replaced, and you have the femora of one person might be put together with all of the thigh bones of all the people. Mm-hmm. You might put all the skulls in one place. It's like you're joining the body of the dead with the community that was their community. And it's not about keeping the body together. It's about getting all the places, getting all the pieces in the right places.
Okay, makes sense. So let's talk about the Rising Star Expedition. Mm-hmm. That's this cave that you were just describing.
Yeah.
When you start an expedition like that, mm-hmm. and you're in there and you've got colleagues, I assume, who are working with you on it, is there, and you know, this might be kind of a naive question, but is there a specific thing that you are hoping to find or a goal you're going for? Or is it just literally, let's just find out what we find out?
Yeah, that's a great question. All of our work is highly collaborative. Okay. Right now I'm working in South Africa. We have a team of 55 full-time people on the ground working in different aspects of the project. Okay. The project is funded and run through National Geographic. My friend Lee Berger, the director in South Africa of the project, and I play a really important role, but there's so many people that do. And the, you know, when we're exploring something new, we usually have a reason why we're there, right? Okay. And in this case, we had, in the Rising Star Cave, we had two guys, Rick Hunter and Stephen Tucker. In 2013, they had been in this cave. They noticed bones in a part of the cave. That part of the cave was one that wasn't on their maps, and so that made it a special interest because it might be something that no one had seen before.
Okay.
And so the first, when you mobilize something to work in a place, it's because you see something that's worth investing in, right? It's mm-hmm. like, in this case, bones on the floor of the cave, the photographs of the bones showed us that these were bones of some sort of human relative.
Yeah.
That kind of discovery motivates investment. It's like, okay, let's find out what this is. Let's get people on the scene who can do this work.
Yeah.
This particular project was a really difficult one to get going because this cave was tough to move in. This place was 40 meters underground, so more than 100 feet underground. Mm-hmm. It is more than 120 meters through the cave, and some of those passages are passages too small for me to pass through.
Yeah.
And so, you know, really needed to have people who had the right skill set to do underground caving, climbing especially, and archaeological skills to record and excavate what they
Small, non-claustrophobic humans.
Exactly. And that's still the case, right? Yeah. We still have incredibly skilled people who are working in these systems. Yeah. We, you know, move into them to investigate new things that we're interested in. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to build a larger context for understanding where these bones have come from. And there are thousands of bones still left in the cave. We are, you know, our goal is not to remove everything that's there. It's to be as minimal as possible in understanding what we've run into so that we can develop scientific hypotheses that we can test about what the situation is.
Okay. So you have to be kind of a spelunker too and have those skills, and hopefully you are not claustrophobic. but so this brings up a practical question. How did, these passages are small and challenging mm-hmm. and difficult, how did Naledi get down there?
You know, that's something that we've really thought about a lot.
Yeah.
And I have a grad student here at UW, Sarah Johnson, who is a climber and who is one of these, you know, smaller than me type of people.
Okay.
And she is, you know, she'll tell you, well, these passages are easy. And I know they're not easy, right? Because I can't pass through them.
Yeah, right.
but I think that that's a perspective that's really valuable, is that if you are the right size and if you have, you know, some, it takes some social skills, right? It takes knowing where you're going. Mm-hmm. It takes having some trust in the people who are, you're going with, because they know the place. They've been there before.
Right.
And this species, Homo naledi, surely had that.
Okay.
They were doing this as a social activity. Their bodies were skinny compared to ours.
Okay,
they were small compared to ours.
Okay.
They had shoulders and hands, especially, that seemed to have been really well made for climbing.
Okay.
And I expect that this was not difficult for them. That doesn't mean that it was a walk in the park, right? But it means that their anatomy was, you know, this was a good match for what their anatomy was.
Okay.
And I think that they would have seen this as being something of a very special place. You know, this is somewhere that we're comfortable being.
Okay. So was this a place where some of them were using it as a home, or were they literally just going down there to hang out?
Where we have the bodies, we have no evidence of food or other kinds of debris associated with living.
Okay.
And so we know that the chambers, and we have bodies from two very distant chambers in the system, those places were not places that Naledi lived.
Okay.
We think it's very likely that that's because these were the farthest places, and they were more familiar with living in some of the places that were maybe closer to the entrance of the cave.
Yeah, I would think you'd want to not have to go home every night by this circuitous tight. That makes sense. But I just figured I would ask because it might be worth the trouble if it provided really good shelter and really good temperature control and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And
we're working in a place where in the wintertime there, it's cold. It gets down below freezing. It snows. Yeah. And the cave is relatively warm in those situations. It's protected from the thunderstorms and bad weather outside. You know, there are parts of this cave that would have been very comfortable, and that's true across the region. You know, I'm working in a region that is, in terms of Wisconsin scale, you know, it's probably about, a third the size or quarter the size of Dane County.
Okay.
And that area has hundreds of caves, more than 600 caves on our survey maps.
Wow.
So it's an area where ancient people and ancient relatives of ours would have been really familiar with both above ground, but also the underground environment.
And is this, if I'm saying it correctly, Witwatersrand?
Witwatersrand, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, terrific. And that's as in the country of South Africa.
Yep.
And 600 caves-ish in an area a quarter the size of Dane County.
Yep, that's precisely right, yeah.
Wow. And are many of them or most of them treasure troves of anthropological delight?
It's fascinating. You know, this area has become known as the cradle of humankind because of the fossils, because there are so many fossils of human relatives. There are more than a dozen caves that have significant fossil evidence of human relatives.
Okay.
Some of those are people like us, modern people. Mm-hmm. Some of them are more as much as 3 million years old and represent species that have been extinct for millions of years. Some of the earliest fossil relatives of ours, Australopithecus africanus, early Homo erectus. Mm-hmm. So the cool thing about it is that caves are like time capsules. They open to the environment because erosion opens up this underground opening. And for some time, they'll gather stuff inside of them. You know, animals use them. Animals might fall into them. Stuff is falling in. It forms deposits of bone and sediment. And then further erosional changes can close the opening.
Right.
And these become, you know, as drip water comes through them, it's calcite rich, it cements stuff together, and you make this sort of fossil mass that can rest there as long as the cave survives.
Right.
And over time, the land surface erodes, and we find the remains of caves that are 2 million years open, that are all that's left of them is this little bit of stuff that junked up the bottom.
Right.
But that stuff has got fossils in it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what we find.
Yeah. Yeah. This reminds me of when I visited the La Brea tar pits, right out in California. These ice age animals would go in this goo and get stuck, a horrible way to die.
Yep.
But then it's this treasure trove of bones that just tell us all kinds of things about the creatures that were around at that time. And you're going way back farther in time. How many, we talked about Naledi, you've mentioned Homo erectus. We know that there are all these different stages. How many identifiable stages, if that's even an answerable question, do we have of human evolution, to your knowledge?
That's a great question. So what we have is a tree.
Okay.
And that tree has cousins of ours that are not our ancestors, but are, you know, sort of, they share ancestors with us. It has some very close siblings of ours. You know, this is like, wow, this is really a close relative of ours. And it has some groups, the Neanderthals are an example, that are not only cousins or siblings of ours, but also our ancestors of ours, because these groups can separate and then remingle and come together.
Right.
And that's what has happened in some of the phases of our evolution.
Okay.
As anthropologists today, we identify more than 20 different groups that are species, that have names, that we recognize are lineages that were different from each other, that had adaptations to environments that were different, and that share one branch or another within this deep tree.
Okay, and some of them overlapped, like Neanderthals were able to not only coexist with was it Erectus, or who was it that they were?
We looked at the world 200,000 years ago, in that world, when our species is really getting going, right? Modern humans, right? We're starting to get going in Africa. At that time, there are in the western half of Eurasia a group called the Neanderthals.
Right.
In the eastern half of Eurasia, there are several different groups that we call Denisovans. And we know about them mostly from their DNA sequences.
Okay.
We actually have DNA from bones that are as much as 200, 300,000 years old.
And what was that word again?
Denisovan.
Denisovan.
We found them at a place in Siberia called Denisova Cave. It's a very special place.
Okay.
Because it is just, it's like, I've been there a number of times. I don't know when I'll get to go again. It's in the middle of Russia, right? But it's a special place because it preserves DNA really well. And when you walk into the cave, it's like walking into a beer refrigerator here in Wisconsin, right? Okay. It's just got that constant 5 degrees Celsius sort of temperature that is absolutely perfect for the DNA preservation. And so it is a cave where we have this deep record of molecules that enables us to look, you know, we until recently didn't even know what this group looked like, but we knew 6 billion base pairs of their DNA, and we knew a lot about their connection with us, how we have some genes from them, and their diversity. And so that is, you know, that kind of evidence has shared the knowledge that our species wasn't alone. It was surrounded by these relatives.
Right.
Same time, 200,000 years ago, in Indonesia and in the Philippines, there are other species that had gotten there probably 1 million years earlier. And those species, Homo floresiensis in the island of Flores, Homo luzonensis in the Philippines, they coexisted probably without much contact with the mainland, but they were waiting there for our species eventually to show up and discover them. And in South Africa, Homo naledi, right? So you have this kind of 5 or 6 different groups that are living in the world together.
Yeah. And how similar were they? Like, could they procreate between?
In the cases of the Neanderthals, Denisovans, modern humans, they did procreate.
Oh, wow.
Right? Okay. When they came into contact, they had kids.
Yeah.
We are their descendants. We had that DNA inside of us.
Yeah.
In the other cases, not clear.
Okay.
We know that there were groups in Africa that lived at the same time our species arose that were pretty different and that did interact, because we can look in today's people's DNA and we can see, oh, you've got this sort of set of genes that looks like it's pretty different from everybody else.
Yeah.
That must have come from somewhere. But we don't yet know whether that contribution has come from a group like Homo naledi, that's possible, or whether it's come from other groups that, you know, maybe we haven't connected the DNA with the fossils yet.
Right.
So that's where we often are right now, is that we have this avenue of looking at the ancestry through DNA that tells us about the shape of the tree. We have avenues of looking at ancient history through fossils and through the stone tools, the archaeology that is left behind. And that tells us some things. Sometimes we're trying to connect them because we don't have that connection in one place, one fossil. we often are hoping for some Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, right.
The skull that has the DNA that shows us the end.
Right.
And
right. It's like the physics people looking for the theory of everything.
That's right. Exactly.
That's terrific. Yep. Wow. What drew you into this? Did 10-year-old John Hawks think, you know, I want to dig around in caves for ancient bones? What pulled you into this direction?
That's a great question. I feel like 10-year-old John Hawks probably did. Cool. I followed National Geographic. I was fascinated by fossils. I was fascinated by, you know, all kinds of science. I grew up in a really small town in western Kansas.
Okay.
And I can tell you that it was not, you know, I didn't imagine really that science was a career. You know, that was not something that as a kid I was thinking about, but I knew I was interested in it. I went to university and I took a course in anthropology that really got me going.
Yeah.
I got a chance to be, you know, a lab TA teaching anthropology, teaching bones, and got the practical side of it. And that was really what enabled me to see that as, you know, there's a career in this. And so that was what got me going.
Okay. And I want to ask you about that term. We've talked about anthropology. We've mentioned the term paleontology. Mm-hmm. You, I believe, would call yourself a paleoanthropologist. So just unpack that a little bit.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
You know, every one of these specialties has further subspecialties, right?
Yeah, right. Of course.
And so, you know, I study ancient things that are human relatives.
And
the interesting thing is that, you know, a paleontologist studies life of the past.
Right.
And in fact, a paleontologist looks at what we most of us would call a biologist, and it says they're neontologists. They study only life of the present. Right.
Ah.
We study life of the past, paleontologists.
Right.
We study ancient things. I accentuate the anthropology because I'm studying cultural things.
Right.
I'm studying things where what's different between the bones of a human relative and the bones of a dinosaur is that the human relative, we know that their lives depended on the culture that they were embedded in.
Right.
And the culture shaped their environment. They were in an environment that was created in part by them.
Yeah.
And so the cultural side of it has such weight and importance to us that when we look at, you know, if I'm working on an ancient site and I'm working on bones of other animals that are found in that site, my first question is, did the hominins, did our relatives bring the animals there? Did they alter those animals?
Right.
Were these animals part of their lives?
Yeah.
Were these animals food for them?
Right.
And so the analysis of the entire assemblage of bones, right, and everything that we find is filtered through the idea that somehow this is part of an environment that was shaped.
Yeah.
And so the anthropology really leads there. It's like we can't approach this like another, you know, any other kind of animal site, right? We have to approach this knowing that the arrangement of things, the way that they were treated, the way that they're broken, the way that they might, you know, the marks on them, those things might have clues about the culture of these hominins that we're studying.
Yeah, of course. That would, you know, be hugely influential. What has, in all of your research, all of your digging in caves, I mean, you're like the star of Raiders of the Lost Ark at this point. You're digging around in these caves looking for crazy stuff. What has either surprised you or maybe just delighted you the most in all of this research?
I think it's always fun to be puzzled, right? Sometimes I publish research and I'll have people in my field, right, say, I don't believe that. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that this burial of the dead thing, right? It's like, I don't believe that they buried their dead. I just don't think they could have done that. And what I love in the work that I do is that I can say, well, here's the evidence that I'm faced with, right?
Yeah.
Tell me what else can explain this.
Right.
I'd love to be in a position of saying that, you know, I don't know what to say about this other than here it is.
Yeah.
And that's fun, right? Because it's like, I'm not, you know, I think a lot of people look at science and they imagine that, you know, the scientists are out there to prove a theory or they've come up with some big idea and they're looking for evidence for it. I'm never in that situation. Right. I'm always in a situation of I happened across this thing and it's puzzling and I'm trying to work out, you know, how to explain it.
Right.
And I am as open as anybody to say to people, look, if you've got a better explanation than me,
yeah,
I want to hear it.
Yeah.
Because we can test it, right? We can look at the evidence. We can take an idea and we can say, geez, I didn't think of that idea before, but it doesn't seem to work very well with this thing and this thing that I found.
Yeah.
Maybe we can actually investigate and find something else that might, you know, disconfirm or make that plausible.
Right. So it's Indiana Jones plus Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like great. Indiana Jones knew what he was looking for.
Yeah, right.
There was
exactly.
No question.
Yeah,
right?
And Sherlock is just looking for a theory that fits the facts.
Exactly. I love when I find that something that nobody was looking for. Right?
Yeah.
That's the thing that is amazing about this is that you find something that's like, I wasn't looking for that. And I'll tell you that I'm still finding them, right? From bones that I excavated, my team worked on, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I'll go back to the lab and I'll be like, wait, we didn't see this.
Yeah.
And with the technology that we apply to them today,
right?
We're working with micro CT scans of many of the fossils.
Yeah.
And every time we're looking at them, we're like, wait, there's something here we didn't recognize.
Yeah.
That's a new clue that's going to tell us about the life of this individual.
Okay, wow. And that's bioinformatics, which I don't even know if we have time to get into that, but that's what you're talking about?
Yeah, precisely, yeah. Right? We're you know, in the genetic side, when we have DNA evidence, we don't have that for our South African fossils.
Yeah.
We do have it for some groups, especially the Denisovans, Neanderthals.
Yeah.
You know, finding those connections and sifting through just reams and reams and reams of data to try to pull out signal, right? It's something that is the most important part of our research on them is to say, we don't know with data. You don't know what to start looking for, right?
Yeah.
And bioinformatics is one kind of approach to sort of take an automated approach to pull out features from data.
Mm-hmm.
With the micro CT imaging that we do on some of the fossils, that approach of looking through them and seeing, I'm going to pull out some information from this.
Okay.
I'm going to see how that connects with other things. That's the power that's there for us in technological approaches to the ancient past.
Terrific. Just two more quick questions. Mm-hmm. One, just sort of a sweep up thing. Is there anything about your research that you would like people to know, but I just haven't asked the right question to get to?
Boy, I'll tell you what. I think, you know, for folks that are listening and they want to know more about this research, they want to, you know, sort of follow along, we are really accessible.
Okay.
You know, my blog, johnhawks.net, it's possible to follow the research that we do, new results, and we're often, you know, able to share something that's really hot off the press.
Yeah. I subscribed to your Substack.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes.
Yeah, I'm all in now.
That is so great because we are able to share a lot of what's going on, and that's really the exciting part of it.
And finally, this is a pretty cool job you have, but when you were talking about these people being spelunkers and climbers and everything, I don't know if you noticed, but I have a little carabiner or earring. I am a rock climber.
Nice.
It's my hobby. I love
it.
Do you have hobbies and activities that you do when you're not digging for bones in caves?
I'll tell you what, I have to say that I never expected to get into this area where it's very physically active.
Yeah.
And you can look at me, right? I don't look like and when I first started working in some of these caves, I have to say that it was very intimidating to me, right? I was not somebody, you know, who thought that I was going to be super claustrophobic, but these caves are intimidating.
Yeah.
And especially some of the areas that we go, I never expected that I would be engaged in that kind of work. And everybody has their limit. Right.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like I can't go some places that I would love to be able to go.
Yeah.
And my team members who can go almost anywhere, right? I work with some of the most experienced cavers on the planet.
Yeah.
Especially for this kind of applied work. There's places they can't go.
Yeah.
And so you just are like, wow, you know. And so when I talk about hobbies, you know, really, I'm into more of the enjoyment of food.
Great.
Enjoyment of wine, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I work in a field where having some sort of encyclopedic knowledge of all of the fossils and their connections is really valuable.
Yeah.
And I like to be able to apply that to other things. You
know,
it's like, let's actually, you know, now let's get into something that's, you know, a little bit more, you know, I can enjoy this after hours, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
that makes perfect sense. Yeah. So many people live kind of mundane lives and then they try to do an occasionally exciting thing, you know, to break out of that. And you're doing the exciting thing for your job. So yeah, sitting down and just going, this is a really good glass of wine, you know, that's going to be a great pleasure for you.
That exactly. The first time that I really was in the Rising Star Cave, I'm going down something and I don't know how easy it's going to be to get out.
Yeah.
And it's different from climbing in the sense of with climbing, you know, you have this challenge of where your hands and feet need to be and what the route is going to be. With caving, that's less of a challenge. Right? You're probably not going to go anywhere if you just let go.
Right.
But you are not going to go forward or backwards unless you figure out which angle your knee has to be in this place, right? And you can't see it.
Right.
Right. So it's like, you know, that proprioception, right? Where your body is and how you need to move it.
Right.
And no one can tell you because you're a different shape than everybody else around you in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Try different permutations of body positions, being careful not to get yourself stuck. Yeah. This is so great. And man, I hope we can talk again because I know another thing that you're interested in is the pace of human evolution. And the fact that it is not a steady pace.
Yep.
I would love to get into that. We don't have time now, but please, please come back and let's do this some more.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. John Hawks, Chair and Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor in the Department of Anthropology. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Our engineer is Maggie Shays. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.